According to recent reporting, for all the talk of Russian espionage, it's Chinese spies who are on the offensive, actively trying to recruit Americans as agents. The Chinese government has long tried to interfere in U.S. affairs, most famously in the 1996 presidential election, when operatives tried to infiltrate the Democratic National Committee with donations of laundered money. But since then, some say the U.S. has let its guard down, and Chinese tactics have changed. Since 2017, the Department of Justice has brought at least a dozen cases against Americans accused of spying for China. In May, Kevin Mallory, a former CIA officer, was sentenced to 20 years for selling China U.S. state secrets, and he was recruited on LinkedIn. Our next guest was as well, but it didn't work. Jonas Perillo Plesner is a former Danish diplomat. He's in Copenhagen. Jonas, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
And well, you're also a fellow at the Hudson Institute, the conservative think tank, and have written a fascinating report about Chinese espionage. We'll get to that. But take us back. 2011, a woman supposedly named Grace Wu approached you on LinkedIn, as business people do. She said she was with a headhunter company in China. You do the usual back and forth with her. But then on a trip you'd already planned to Beijing, you were supposed to meet with her. When three men walk in the room, there's no Grace Wu. What did they say to you? Tell us about that.
Well, that meeting was odd and was already a couple of days leading up to the meeting a bit conspicuous. I was interested in meeting state-owned companies that was part of my research at that time on Chinese affairs, and but being cagey about who was actually then I was going to meet. And these three men did quite unusual start off the meeting by not giving business cards, which is otherwise sort of the whole ritual in Chinese meetings. So it's almost like in a Western meeting if you showed up half naked. So that was really sort of odd. And then started this long spiel about how my articles that I'd written on China were important. It was important with people who understood China really well. And then they came to a point where they're like, but we would like to sort of support your research. And then I was playing a little dumb and sort of, oh, you mean my think tank where I was then affiliated, their research. Because we do have sort of affiliations with, and they're like, no, it's you specifically. And I was like, oh, I can see where this is turning.
They wanted to give you money. They wanted to lure you in as you started to realize, of course you declined, but what were you realizing? What were you thinking?
Well, yeah, I was thinking that these are some of the things I worked with. So this was seeing it in practice and how the Chinese system sort of uses many different sort of conduits. It's actually... Espionage, as you mentioned in the intro, is one thing, and that should, of course, be dealt with sort of through counter-espionage. But it's also a much broader phenomenon that the Chinese try to use LinkedIn, many other means, to gain influence in the West and basically pass their messages. I didn't follow it up, so I mean, it could have been that they wanted classical espionage. It could also have been they just wanted me to be a, so to speak, friend of China that would publish nice things about China, which is really important for China and for the Communist Party in China to sort of get positive news media stories out about China. We see it right now with Hong Kong and everything that's happening there, where Chinese state-driven media have paid ads on social media to get their version of what's happening with the democracy protest out.
Well, and as you already knew, because this is your field, you're not alone. There are thousands of attempts to contact people on LinkedIn by the Chinese or to contact Americans in person. We read of a linguist at a military base. She took a taxi to work every day. There was a very nice Chinese driver who was friendly to her, let her practice her Chinese. Then he started asking weird questions. He was later arrested as part of a Chinese spy ring in California. You say the Chinese are building these long relationships as opposed to the Russians who make quick hits. This is the so-called Chinese United Front. There are things like the Confucius Institutes. These are schools teaching language but really influencing. Paid articles in American media meant to look like real news but actually propaganda. And they also want to co-opt Chinese communities in other countries. And it's important to note that you are not talking about all Chinese. You say that the mainland Chinese have been targeting the Chinese in the U.S.
No, that's correct. I think it's really important. Well, you outlined quite well many of the sort of things where we see Chinese interference and influence operations. And, you know, some of it is out in the open. When China Daily, a state-driven newspaper, buys an ad in a U.S. newspaper, I don't think it should happen, but it's still sort of out there in the open. The problem is really when the things are also covered or, of course, illegal. So when you, for example, have a Confucius Institute that's technically only supposed to be doing language education, but then you see that they gradually sort of stifle academic freedom at the broader university institution where they're embedded by trying to sort of influence whether Chinese human rights defenders, Tibetans, even a Dalai Lama could visit university. So it's these type of effects that are basically sort of more covered and where they change academic freedom, freedom of speech inside our countries. And that's also the real danger for Chinese American communities and other Chinese diaspora communities is that the Chinese Communist Party, through this united front, has an effect inside their communities. For example, a Chinese American journalist whose wife was then subsequently disappeared in China and later did a sort of video on YouTube where she denounced her husband's work clearly under duress. And that's the type of things where you basically see the Chinese Communist Party using the open access there is in the U.S. and in Western society's system to exploit that.
Yeah. Well, and you say this so-called United Front has been most successful in Australia, for instance, where there are loose campaign finance laws. If you could just very, very briefly remind us what happened there.
Yeah, Australia became really sort of the poster example of China's United Front work over the whole sort of spectrum. On the political side, it basically meant that sort of Chinese front companies were funding, particularly the Labour Party, but actually both sort of main parties in Australia. And when it all got sort of blown up was when an Australian senator was speaking about the South China Sea with speaking points that were clearly sort of written in Beijing and everybody else should keep out of the South China Sea, and something that sounded completely off for an Australian politician to say. And then suddenly these links, including financial, to him personally as well, were discovered. Mm. And that sort of started a bigger investigation in Australia into this, and actually to a change of laws, both on campaign finance and the way sort of foreign agents can work inside Australia.
Yeah, well, and you point to a lot of solutions, including there being more investigations, more awareness on the part of the press in particular. We'll link people to your writing at hereandnow.org. But that said, how worried should Americans be? We hear of your own experience. Here you are, a Chinese expert. If you get, you know, roped into a meeting with the Chinese who might want to co-opt you, what chance do other people have? But on the other hand, people might say, well, the U.S. has spies as well. But then on the other hand, we're also in the middle of a trade war with China. So how would you characterize this particular moment when it comes to what you've laid out and the Chinese trying to insinuate themselves into an American politics?
Well, I think people in all sectors need to be probably much more vigilant than we have been. So, I mean, there's been a lot of look at China in a sort of prism of business is business, and this is mainly a good sort of making money opportunity. And to some extent, it was, and it still is. But increasingly, there's also the realization that the Chinese Communist Party, which has gone in a authoritarian direction over the last decade, and particularly under Xi Jinping, also uses its different means to sort of influence us in Western democracies. And that's where we have to be aware of that. So we don't have to, of course, paint suddenly all Chinese as potential spies, but we just have to be sort of slightly more vigilant so that the Chinese don't want to steal our trade secret and military secrets as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, that is a question. How do you keep this from turning into a slippery slope, a McCarthy-like witch hunt with the fear of the Chinese?
That's why I think you should start from the sort of civil rights approach of saying, well, there are actually Chinese Americans that are subjected, as the example I mentioned earlier, with a Chinese American journalist whose wife then had to denounce him in China. So there are people that come to the U.S. because of the protection, because of the freedom that's in the U.S. and actually realize that the Chinese Communist Party have a lot of stooges and people that are loyal to them also inside the U.S. So I think clamp down on that part and then of course, be still open to general Chinese students and collaboration in other areas.
Yeah. As you write, the Chinese diaspora needs to be protected around the world from the mainland Communist Chinese Party that has been targeting them. Jonas Perello-Plesner, former Danish diplomat, who the Chinese attempted to recruit back in 2011. It did not work. Jonas, thanks so much for speaking to us about this.
Thank you, Robin. It was a pleasure.